Welcome to Frameline. I'm Barbara Gosofsky, here as usual with my favorite critic, Courtney Small.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Great, how are you?
I'm doing well. Excited for the conversation today.
Good, yeah, me too. We're going to start with a big, epic film that a lot of people have been waiting for, myself included. Well, both of us included. I think we're both fans of Dune Part 1. And Dune Part 2 just opened. So hopefully people have seen it. Apparently it's been so popular to see it in IMAX, which is the way I think it should be seen. It's been so popular in IMAX that they have 3 a.m. screenings because it's so packed and the demand is so high. There's a bit of pride for us as Canadians because our own Denis Villeneuve, yes, he's gone Hollywood, but he's done it well. He's done it the right way. Denis Villeneuve, he's part of the team that adapted it, but also this book. He's part of the team that adapted the book by Frank Herbert Dune for this version. And he is the director once again of this part. And so, yes, epic science fiction film. It takes place on this mythic planet of Arrakis. It's got this spice that everybody wants. I mean, that's basically the main. It's a desert-like place, so you can imagine there's a lot of. If you don't know it, there's a lot of. It coincides a lot with, you know, places on Earth. There's overtones of colonialism, and, you know, especially in this one, you're going to see that there's overtones of religious fundamentalism. The whole thing is about power because everyone wants the spice. And so who gets control of the spice? And so the main character, who's played by Timothée Chalamet, is Paul Atreides. And after part one, where he sort of established his family and the relationships, the relationship between him, sort of like more of a royal family, with all these other families all jockeying for control, and the Fremen, who are actually the people that live in sort of the desert area where the spices, and they know how to like live there. Like they're actually like the what you call like the indigenous people who like know in their own way. They really have a certain power that nobody else can have, right? What happens in part one, I don't know if I should ruin this for people, but something that happens at Paul Atreides. He wants to seek revenge. So he gets together with the Fremen. In the meantime, he has already fallen in love with Chani, who's played by the amazing Zendaya. And who wouldn't fall in love with her? I mean, I certainly did. So he has to navigate his own personal feelings, and he has to navigate what's going on in this world and navigate the concerns of these people, the Fremen, and the fate of the universe, because he's getting these visions of what's going to happen and what he needs to do to prevent a certain catastrophe from happening. It's like a chock full of superstars, this one. I'm just gonna like name a couple. Josh Brolin comes back. Florence Pugh is there. Christopher Walken. There's no surprise he's in the commercials, so it's not like it's a surprise appearance. Lea Seydoux. But I think the biggest surprise for me. I think Javier Bardem does not get enough credit. I'm going to say it already. But I think the biggest surprise is what an amazing transformation Austin Butler goes through as one of the baddest villains you'll ever encounter. He is absolutely enticing. Before I throw it to you, Courtney, I'll just say that this works best as an epic spectacle. Yeah, you can see it in 70 millimeter. You can see it in IMAX. It's kind of worth, I think, seeing it in IMAX because of the fact that it works best as a spectacle. I think once you start to take it apart, you start, like, for me, there was one point I was like, there's too many white people on screen. What's going on? There's too many, like, hints of, like, Arab stories and Arab histories and stuff going on in the film, but no Arabs on screen. So, and this whole, you know, colonialism, it's like, do we really interrogate colonialism simply through the mostly focusing on the power struggles between the white people? Is that the best way? But yeah, it's based on a novel. So there's only so much Denis Villeneuve could have done. It's just that knowing his earlier work like Encendie, and even his first feature, August 32nd on Earth, which takes place in a desert, it's like the man knows his deserts, you know, and he knows, and especially in Encendie, he has a respect for, you know, this Arab community. And he's gone to Hollywood a little bit too much in that respect. But as a spectacle, I was riveted and I did not even feel the 2-hour and 41-minute running time of this. So my two cents.
No, I agree with a lot of what you say. Like, I absolutely love this film. I had some issues with the first one when I first saw it. My issues kind of softened when I revisited again recently, but this one I absolutely loved. And I think part of the reason I loved it was for some of the things that irked you a little bit about it. Because yes, he is taking Frank Herbert's novel from the 60s. And, you know, this film, it's very heavy on the symbolism, not only just like the religious aspects of it, you know, the whole idea of the savior, in this case, this white savior, almost like a religious figure that the indigenous people have been hearing stories of. But you also have, as you mentioned, the whole notion of colonialism. You know, you have two very powerful families with armies fighting over this planet that is full of resources, but don't really care about the people who are indigenous to that planet. You know, they see them as, you know, the Harkonnen call them rats. You know, the Harkonnen has very little respect, whereas the Atreides at least see them as people that want to try and build a, at least in the first one, a type of respectful rapport while still pillaging the resources of their land. So you have that going on. You have the colonialism, you've got the religion, and then you've also got the politics. And there's so much occurring in this film. It's, as you mentioned, it's 2 hours and like 40 some odd minutes. And about halfway through, I was like, there is so many different strands and threads going on. There's so much to absorb. I'm not even talking about the visual, which in itself are inspiring, but with all the messiness and the way how it makes you think, rather intentionally or unintentionally, but I think it was very intentional, of our current society and the way how that politics and religion are often mixed in ways that we don't necessarily want to acknowledge. We often like to think of them as two separate things, but you really can't have one without the other. But also, there are people in there who, whether they are people of faith or not, love power more and will do whatever they can to manipulate things, even if it comes to manipulating faith, to ensure that their power maintains. And I absolutely loved how this film takes all those strands, all the messiness of you know, the science fiction world that we're observing, but also reminding us that, hey, this stuff isn't really that far-fetched, because a lot of it is what we have been experiencing for years. Some would argue we're experiencing right now in a very visceral way with what's going on in the Middle East. And yet, it still manages to be a really entertaining science fiction film. You know, Butler is great, partly because he's so menacing. You kind of ignore the whole, he's still got that Elvis style voice that I guess is going to be with him from now on. But it's very,
he doesn't. He totally transforms. Just to interrupt you just for 1 second. No trace of Elvis. there's like, that's the amazing thing about his performance. Completely transforms into some other menacing, awful, evil, wicked being.
And some of
But
that, I think, is like, for me, I still heard tinges of the voice, but I think I didn't see him as Elvis. Just the voice. I'm like, oh, you still got that voice. But he was definitely menacing. And I think part of it is also how they create the Harkonnen world around him. Like, just in the fact that the Harkonnens are decked out in black, but are also just very pale as regular individuals, creatures, whatever you want to call them.
oh, no. They're extra white, Courtney. Come on. So those makeup people did something. They are so white. But also, I haven't read it fully, but there's all this stuff about how the scenes with them were shot with like infrared cameras,
Oh,
and
okay.
that's got to do something to enhance, especially I guess if you've got the white makeup on. Just that's what I just said is not fact. That is my speculation, and that means like I'm gonna go research it and probably not talk about it on Frameline because we're talking about it now. But you know, like there's in terms of effects and visuals, yeah. But I keep interrupting you, Ian, and that's a
No,
horrible. Yeah,
that's
sorry.
fine, because there's a lot to unpack. And I do think the visuals are quite fascinating, because in the Harkonnen world, it is very monochromatic, very black and white. But then how they utilize that, like, there's a scene where Butler's character, Feed, forgetting what his name is, but he is in this arena. And then you see in this arena, you see like a kind of shadow move in the background, and you realize that they're like these people, but they're faceless people with these horn heads, and it's just a really cool look visually. But then you think about when they're on Arrakis and how everything has a kind of burnt orange tinge to it, right? Like, it's almost like the sand is impacting, the spice is impacting our eyes in terms of how we are seeing the various filters. Like, there's so much in this film that is just stunning to look at, which makes also the action sequences really fascinating as well. And normally, with a lot of these Hollywood blockbusters, you get a lot of visual spectacle with very little food for thought. But Denis Villeneuve has never been that type of director that just gives you empty calories. And here, there's so much to think about, and it's all done in a really thrilling way. Like, I took my son to see the film. I actually just showed him the first one, I guess a couple of days ago, and we went to see it in IMAX, and he didn't get all of the politics,
Yeah.
but he quite enjoyed it. And then also for him, realizing that, hey, Frank Herbert's Dune is kind of like the precursor to Star Wars,
Yeah.
he could look at it in terms of Star Wars logic and go, oh, so this character is like this. And that helped him understand a bit of like certain people's motivations and thing. Like, he didn't necessarily get all of the stuff about the religious symbolism, and there were aspects of the book, and this is the last thing I'll say, and I'll let you speak, is one of the flaws I had, I guess, with both versions, is because he's adapting the novel, there are certain things that he leaves out that I think are kind of, they're little things, but they're crucial in terms of understanding character relationships. Like Frances Pugh's Princess Irulan character, there's a decision that's made involving her towards the end of the film. And I feel that in the novel, there are certain things that kind of lead up to it that explain it. Whereas in this film, it feels like a complete 180. Like, he's built up this really epic story, this epic love story, what have you. And then she's like a side character, but then she becomes a really pivotal character by the end. And I don't feel like he sets up some of those relationships well enough. But then again, there's so much going on in this film that, I guess there's going to be certain things left on the cutting room floor. But I just wish that some of those key moments was tied in a bit better.
When it comes to that moment, which I think you're talking about,
Yeah, towards the end,
the
towards the end.
180, yeah, towards the end, that the 180, and I think it involves Timothée Chalamet's character. Yeah, okay. Then I don't, I, when it comes to adaptations, I don't know if this is overly simplistic, but it's a certain stance I have on films. which is a film is a film and a book is a book. Mm-hmm. And yes, sometimes I like to compare the two, but I want to see a film first as a film to see if it, you know, and this film definitely delivers as a film. So
yes,
I have no way of comparing that scene, but I do know that for me, as not knowing what you knew in the backstory to what happens in that moment, that it was part of the transformation that's happening with Timothy Chalamet's character, Paul's character, that was part of the overriding disturbing thing that was going on, the disturbing messages, the political messages, but mostly the religious fundamentalist sort of, you know, white savior message, that was absolutely in keeping with what was going on with that character, with his character. Mm-hmm. And it had to be that dramatic, and it had to be, you know,
that kind of gut punch.
It made perfect sense. It made perfect sense. And the fact that it came like that was like, that's what I needed for it to have full impact.
Mm-hmm.
As the full impact, and sort of be like a climactic moment in this development where, like, he's developing in a certain way after a certain point in the film, which delivers that message about the fundamentalism and the dangers of the powers of religion, and, you know, and how they get.
Yeah.
But I think it's very powerful, whether you've seen, well, maybe more powerful if you haven't read the mm-hmm. book right before you see the film, right? I mean, it's been a while since I read the book, so. And I'm sort of avoiding it.
No, that's fine. Yeah.
I just want to see these films as films. And the thing that I enjoyed about part one and part two was that I do remember the book being full of all this detail. And it's like, yeah, how do you film that? And everybody's talking about, how do you film this unfilmable novel? And Denis Villeneuve, he found a way, which is you have to pare down some of the, because in a film, you can't have that level of detail that you have in a book, in a novel. It's just, they're just two different mediums. So they deliver their messages differently. And Villeneuve delivers his visually. And yeah, I completely agree about all the stuff and all the messiness that Villeneuve manages to convey through his film. And it's like mostly visually. But this, his skill, which he's always shown this skill, is juggling and bringing together all the mess into something coherent. And that is what he's done with this film. And so that these messages that he's giving us about politics and religion and colonialism, they are crystal clear. So yep. Whether you want to think about them or not, the message is delivered. Maybe I at the beginning when we started this, I was a bit oversimplistic when I said, you know, this is best as a big screen epic. No, it's, you know, the more we talk about it, the more I realize. And that's the great thing about a great film. Yeah. The more you talk about it, the more you realize something. And what I'm realizing is, no. The more you unpack it, there is a lot going on and there is more. And it's like, it just makes me want to see it again.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I think the second viewing will be even better. And this is saying someone who absolutely loved the first viewing, and just even watching it the second time around and just focusing on the way how power corrupts even when you have the best intentions. Like he tries, Paul Atreides tries so hard to avoid doing a certain thing, but then other people kind of orchestrate it so that he has no choice but to do the thing he wanted to avoid, but he still thinks, I can fix it. And it's obviously, you know, things happen and you start to see that in going down this path that other people have said, he himself, you know, you're both rooting for the hero who in some ways is kind of becoming the villain, even though he thinks he's still the hero, right? Which is almost even more dangerous. Like, it's a really fascinating work. And it's just a really thrilling and exciting piece of cinema, which, you kind of hope for big screen blockbusters like this that really feel like an event film, but also something that you walk away where you can think about and really discuss.
Absolutely, and discuss and debate and take, you know, and then go back and see it again and see more. This is like old-fashioned cinema, you know, and old-fashioned in the best way, you know. It's like, you know, I'm sure like when Lawrence of Arabia came out, people were like, oh my God, you know, like look at this and look at this epic big screen vision. And it's like, no. Now we have the benefit of Lawrence of Arabia in the past, and then add this on top of it and see how far we've come in terms of that. And also, yeah, in terms of all the like what's been happening with Dune, the previous version of Dune, the novel, the unfilmability, if that's the word, of the
Yeah, the
novel.
David Lynch version.
Yeah, it was the David Lynch version. Okay, I'm gonna stop babbling about this now.
No, it's a great film. I'll talk briefly about another film that I just saw recently. I guess it's just been added to Netflix. It is nowhere near the level of Dune, but it is a action comedy called Freelance. It's directed by Pierre Morel, who did, I guess. The film that I remember him directing the most was Taken with Liam Neeson, the kind of lean action film where Liam Neeson is a former special agent with a certain set of skills, and his daughter gets abducted by sex traffickers while in France, and he has to free her the only way that a butt-kicking Liam Neeson can do. And I'm a big fan of that film. I know it got mixed reviews, but in this new one, you have John Cena and Alison Brie, who you might remember from Community or the show, the series Glow. And in it, John Cena plays an ex Special Forces agent who's now a lawyer. And through an old acquaintance played by Christian Slater, he is tasked with escorting this journalist played by Alison Brie to, as she goes to interview this dictator in the South American country. And it just happens to be a dictator that killed a lot of John Cena's fellow army special forces buddies way back when. So there's that kind of, he's got to protect this journalist, but he also hates the man that he's been sent to protect her from. But anyway, long story short, a coup happens as they're supposed to be having this interview. And because of it, the three of them, Cena, Brie, and the dictator, all have to kind of fight for survival. And then the quote unquote action comedy hijinks occur. I say that in quote unquote because there is nothing remotely entertaining about this film. It is a film where they have a couple of blooper reels at the very end of it, and the blooper reels showed far more charisma from John Cena and Alison Brie than anything in the actual movie. Like this, I don't know, the action was very paint by numbers. It wasn't exciting whatsoever. And then just the characters were written so poorly that even like the quote unquote comedic quips just fall flat. And it's one of those where you look at it and you see the potential. You know, you think of like, oh, this could have been a really fun movie back in the 90s. You know, there could have been some kind of like Romancing the Stones type chemistry, or even the humor of like a Schwarzenegger Stallone, but everything falls completely flat in this one. And I think this is gonna be one of those films that I guess joins a long line of Netflix films where you have major stars, big budget film that would feel, that's supposed to feel like the theatrical blockbusters, and it just falls completely flat. So I definitely do not recommend Freelance. I would say, hey, revisit Taken again because it's a far better film than you probably remember.
Oh no, that's too bad.
It happens. It happens. Now, they can't all be winners, but
No.
if we're going to talk about a streaming recommendation, there's a series that I know you watched, and I both I watched as well, Mr. and Mrs. Smith,
Yes.
the modern adaptation of the, I guess, iconic Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie action comedy. And it was a series that I guess before it got released, people were already kind of griping about it and, oh, why do we need an adaptation of that movie? The movie was fine, because again, we're in this weird cycle where we seem to want all the things we loved repackaged and resold to us. But having seen Mr. and Mrs. Smith in its entirety, I am fine with this case in terms of repackaging, because how they invented it, I thought was, dare I say, far more entertaining than the actual feature film version. And I'm a fan of the feature film, but this one I absolutely loved, because you don't just have a couple that are undercover spies. You're watching two people who are thrown together for a job have to pretend to be a married couple, and then in the process go through all the stages of awkwardness that comes with falling in love and actually connecting with someone who might actually be the person for you, but also you're now learning their quirks, both big and small, and having to try and deal with that while also working in a very dangerous situation where you can't trust anyone, including the person that might be sleeping in the same house with you. So I thought Donald Glover's adaptation was really, really quite well. And Maya Erskine, who plays Jane Smith, is, I think, fantastic as the partner in job and also partner in love.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this. I don't think I liked it as much as you did. I love Donald Glover's work. You know, I absolutely loved Atlanta. And I love the way in Mr. and Mrs. Smith, excuse me, the way that he sort of blew up the Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie movie, metaphorically, and, you know, you'll know when you see it. But the way he sort of blew that apart, and the way he sort of invokes the sort of conventions of spies and spy movies, spy shows, he invokes the conventions of romance, falling in love, relationship, you know, and he plays around with them. You know, I really do love the way he does that and the way that he generally plays around with things. But I just found that sometimes it was a little too jarring. Like, each episode is a different part of their mission, like a different adventure, you know, stage in their mission. So you're going to have different cuts and like different jumps and like different. But so the through line is them. That's the through line. And the through line is their connection to their boss via computer and like how well they think they're doing and the kind of feedback that they're getting. But I just found after a couple of episodes, I could see that like intellectually, I thought they're incredible actors, you know, and they just seem to be some sort of chemistry, something between them. And then there was something that I was just not connecting to with them. And I couldn't figure it out. And it was like, maybe it was too much plot, but it's a spy show. So it's like, I've watched spy series before and I have fallen for the characters. So this is a total cop-out, especially, you know, in terms of a critic talking about something, but I can't for the life of me figure out why. All I can say is that it just felt jarring sometimes.
No, and that's fine. I've talked to some people that didn't like it because they thought it relied too heavily on the relationship subplot and not enough on like the action spy stuff. I think one of the reasons I liked it so much was because it focused on the relationship, but also I really liked the fact that each episode was its own kind of contained quirky story. So the through line is the couple, but I like that one day you see them working in Italy and going through the problems. And I thought the guest stars on it were brilliantly cast. And the next day they're meeting people who might actually be in the same line of work as them, which is a very rarity in having to deal with that. And then even like there's a whole therapy storyline in one episode. Like each episode felt so uniquely contained, but yet still felt at home with the greater story. Like they might make reference to an individual, a character, a neighbor who Jane might be flirting with a little too much in a couple of episodes, you know, so kind of keep those people in the back of your mind. But also, I just like that sometimes they worked well as a couple, and other times they were at their breaking point, which is kind of like what happens a lot with relationships, especially in the early stages. And you're seeing two people that in some ways are reluctant to compromise because they're so set in their own ways, and having to try and compromise while not fully being able to trust who your heart is saying you should trust, but your mind and your job and your profession are saying you should never trust anyone, I thought was quite fascinating.
You know what? What you just said made me realize that this is my problem. It's not the relationship, because the relationship was fascinating because these are two broken kind of people who are like not, are having trouble trusting each other, right? It is the spy missions, because they're not developed enough. There's too much going on. Yeah, maybe. But like, maybe the criticisms you heard where people are like, oh, there's too much relationship. It's like, no, I didn't mind the relationship. Keep that. Keep all the relationship stuff. But there are decisions that they made as spies that were like, I can't believe you're, like, you're trusting these people, or you're doing what? Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, that doesn't make any sense. You're supposed to be a lot more cynical than I am and a lot more careful. And I would never, never do that. I would never trust that person. I would never, you know, I have to stop because I'm going to give away something, but.
Yeah, no, that's, I understand that. I took it more as, even though they're professionals, I felt like they were professionals at solo work. And it became having to do like the team up stuff is where they were very, very green. And because of it, they were trying, they didn't have teams navigating each other, but then also exactly like who to trust. There's a particular couple, as I said, that they meet that work in the same field, and they completely just open up to in a way that you're like, oh, you probably shouldn't be doing that. You know, like they do make some really crucial decisions. Yeah,
that made that was like they lost me. They lost as soon as they did that. It's like no.
But then I also liked how they, if in some of those cases, like I'm thinking like the therapy episode, how they realize that they've opened up, and then they have to revert to like whatever, resort to whatever is the easiest possible way to fix it as quickly as possible. And it's still, to me, it was done in an amusing way that I was willing to go, yeah, I can see them blundering because they're getting way too comfortable with each other. And yeah, they're a messy group, but I could enjoy the series.
I think, yeah, I mean, I would recommend the series because there is enough there to like, definitely. So then it sounds like you definitely recommend it. So
yeah, I don't, if they do another season, I'm fine with it. But at the same time, I'm happy if they just stick with one. Like I sometimes wish these series outside of Reacher, because I'm a big fan of Reacher, just do one solid episode, solid season.
Yeah.
And I'm good. I don't need to know what happens next. I can create that in my own mind.
Yeah. This is good. I wish somebody would listen to you.
Well, that's how that's not a successful business model though for any streaming service out there.
Well, no. I mean, if they followed your business model, they followed your advice, they would just then take their energy. If they finished the show after one season, they would take their energy and go find another idea that was better, mm-hmm. Or put more energy into something that had potential and then develop a better season, or, you know?
Yep.
So I think you could potentially be like a big hit in that business. But don't go, okay? Because I need you here.
Oh yeah, they would not take that business model. That's why we have like Transformer, I don't know, 6 or 7 coming out, and Fast & Furious 11, and what Mission Impossible 82. They They will not take my business plan.
You know, your great great grandchildren will be watching Mission Impossible 40.
Yep. All spells, just reboot it, rework it.
Just keep reworking those same stories. So on that happy or scary note, depending on how you look at it, I'm going to close off the show for both of us. For Courtney Small, I'm Barbara Gosofsky. This has been Frameline. Thanks for listening.